Before we get to this episode, just to say thanks to everyone who's bought my new book, Champion Thinking, How to Find Success Without Losing Yourself. Published by Bloomsbury, the response has been terrific. It's an Amazon bestseller. It's been top 20 in the airport charts consistently, and the reviews have been terrific right across the board. And if you like this episode that you're about to hear on Flow, you'll be sure to enjoy Champion Thinking. Head to my website, simonmundy.com, or Amazon, Waterstone, Smith's, places like that, to get your copy.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is Don't Tell Me the Score, the podcast that uses sport to explore life's bigger questions. My name is Simon Mundy, and each week I sit down with an expert, from the biggest sporting names in the world to Buddhist monks, neuroscientists, psychologists, and philosophers. We discuss a theme that tells us something insightful and important about life and how best to live it, from the importance of self-acceptance to facing addiction and developing resilience, right through to getting your circadian rhythms in sync and how to sleep better. Sport is a metaphor for life, and in this podcast, I aim to prove that right. I always like hearing from you, so the best way to get in touch is via my website, simonmundy.com, or I'm at Simon Mundy on social media. In this episode, I'm talking to the former Ironman athlete Lucy Gossage about self-talk. Hi, Lucy.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Absolute pleasure to have you on, aka the Duracell Bunny. That's a new name, isn't it?
I quite like that. I think that's 10 years old exactly 2 days ago, Facebook told me.
How did you get Chris in that?
John Leveson, who's the editor of Tri247, so the big triathlon website, I think he met me when I was just getting into triathlon and was struck by my non-stop talking, I think, and bouncing around after doing a race. And he gave it to me, and it stuck all the way. So, yeah, I take it as a compliment.
It certainly meant as one. And you do definitely have this propensity to sort of bounce around, dancing and grinning when you're racing. Like, you clearly love competing over mammoth distances.
Oh, I do, and I miss it. I miss it so much, I've actually entered a race.
Oh, the comeback. I like it.
Okay. No, it's not a comeback, but I do. I loved it so much, and that's why I got good at it, and that's why I carried on with it for so long.
Also, you've been described as an expert in suffering. You suffer when you do an Ironman, but also you work as an oncologist, so, you know, you are around suffering in clearly more ways than one.
I've never heard myself described as that, so that's a new one to me. But what I would say is that in Ironman, yeah, we suffer, but that's a choice, and I remind myself that it's a choice, and it's a privilege, and that makes the suffering to me. You know, it's you're suffering because you're getting the best out of yourselves. I always think it sounds quite trite, but seeing how my patients deal with so much adversity, and you know, every single person manages stuff that I just think I couldn't deal with, but humans do, that's suffering. And I think that can be quite powerful inspiration for me.
And it's clearly affected your outlook and perspective and self-talk, all sorts of things that we're going to dig into. By the way, that expert in suffering, that was the headline of an article. I'll send it your way afterwards.
Interesting.
And you've also described Iron Man as a metaphor for life, which is perfect, because that's kind of the way I try and describe sport for the benefit of this podcast as well. So in what way do you think Iron Man is a metaphor for life?
I think the first time I used that was one of my friends and one of my really good friends, and he was trying to qualify for the World Championships, and he'd just tried and he'd tried and he'd tried again. He kept going back and he kept failing and he kept going back, and then eventually he did on his eighth race, and it was just such a magical experience because it was my last World Championship, so we went out together, and yeah. But I guess it just sums up, you know, all the lessons that I've learned from triathlon are so translatable to normal life. And it's about persistence and discovering yourself and pushing. It is a metaphor for life in so many ways. There's a lot I don't like about the organisation, but as a challenge, and that doesn't have to be Ironman, any kind of huge physical challenge that requires dedication over a long period of time, I think you learn a lot about yourself as a personality.
And you say that oncology and Ironman are remarkably complementary.
Yeah, do you know, I think I was, before triathlon, I was very much on a career ladder, climbing up it as quickly as possible, but not really thinking about where I wanted to go and where the ladder was taking me. And then I moved to Cambridge to do a PhD. I wasn't seeing patients. I was stuck in a lab. I didn't really know what I was doing, what the point of my PhD was. I felt like I had no purpose, no job satisfaction. And that's when training became training rather than exercising, and I started to get better at triathlon. But I think now, looking back, my time as a triathlete has helped me really reflect on what I want to do from life. And I don't want to just be at the top of a ladder just because it's at the top. I'd much rather be lower down the ladder that I'm on. And I still work part-time. I have lots of time to do other projects that I'm passionate about. I don't say yes to stuff just because it's prestigious or it might look good. I only say yes to stuff that I really want to do, and that's, I'm so happy that I've let myself come off that stupid career ladder that would never, you know, you never get the best out of yourself if you're doing something just because it's prestigious. You always get the best out of yourself if you're doing something because you really want to, not just because you can. And that's, yeah, I'm really happy that triathlon's taught me that.
I mean, you're kind of talking about balance and understanding what makes you tick. So I guess that's what you're getting at there, is understanding what makes you happy.
So, you know, when you're at school, most people are told to go to university, and then, you know, there are certain universities and you do things because it's the best thing to do, or because it pays more, or because it's more prestigious. And I don't think anyone who's ever done something because it pays more or because it's on paper the best. You know, I went to Cambridge as an undergrad, but then I went back to Cambridge to do my PhD because it was the best place on paper, inverted commas, to do my PhD. And I didn't look into the project. That is never the right way to make a decision. And, you know, now people sometimes question why I still work part-time, and I often get the answer, you know, I haven't got kids. Most people work part-time because they've got kids, and that's kind of the norm for working part-time. Every now and then I feel like I have to justify that decision. But actually, I know that when I'm in work, I'm in work 100%. And when I'm not in work, I've got time and energy to do other things that make me happy, like riding my bicycle, but also I hope has potential to impact more people, like my charity work and stuff. And I listen, one of the things that has actually changed my the way I looked was in an interview, and I can't remember his name, that you did with a rugby player who was paralyzed.
Ed Jackson.
That's it. And he was talking about how he makes decisions about how he manages his time. And I'd started working through COVID. I ended up working full-time just because they couldn't get a locum, and I said I'd work full-time. And I was cycling back from work on a Friday night, and I was tired. And the last patient I'd seen, I hadn't asked the questions that I would normally have asked, partly because I knew they'd upset her and I couldn't touch her, and I didn't want... I realised this all reflecting, it wasn't conscious, but I didn't want her to cry and me have to watch with a mask and not be able to touch her. But also, it was 5 o'clock, I'd been there five days a week, you know, I'd worked however many hours. I was just done with seeing people with cancer, and I cycled back, I felt really bad. I was like, I'm not the doctor that I want to be. And then I listened to this interview about how he decided how to spend his time, and intrinsically, you know, what made him happy, what benefited other people. And it's just clear as daylight. I was like, why would I ever work full time? All it does, it makes me an average doctor for 5 days, whereas I like to think I could be a really good doctor for 3 days and then do 5K your way and then do other things. And it was just, yeah, it was like a light bulb. So I cycled home. I was like, there's no way once I've, you know, as soon as they've got this locum, there's no way I'm going to carry on.
So it sounds like, you know, you realised you weren't
getting the most out of your career for yourself as well, and then not being able to give to your patients in that way. So it's just getting that balance right.
Yeah, and not feel bad about not, you know, not working full time. Because I think there is still a norm that you work 5 days a week, even, you know, you make the decision, I don't need lots of money. And so money doesn't make me happy. Time makes me happy. And doing things like 5K your way makes me happy. Stuff like this makes me happy. Being in the hospital 3 days a week, I love it. Being in the hospital 5 days a week, it's too much for me. And Ed's system was really helpful at helping me kind of clarify that.
And I wonder if more people are going to be thinking that way because of what's gone on with coronavirus. Has anyone been picking your brains about that decision and saying, you know, perhaps they're considering a similar thing?
I hope so. So at the start of COVID, I was originally really really anxious and scared about what was going to happen in the hospitals. But then I kind of had this hope that the world would change and everyone would. It's almost like everyone in the world has been told they've got cancer. And no one knows where they're going to be in 6 months. And that's a real opportunity to evaluate what you want from life. And I had this hope that everyone would almost have that you've got cancer moment without having cancer and really change, you know, realize what's important to them. I don't know whether that's, I'm sure it will have done for some people. I think there's a natural habit to just creep back to normality, isn't there? But I think that is a real opportunity, and I like to think that people will change and realize who is important to them, what's important to them, and change their life going forwards to accommodate that.
Let's go back, because when you were a young buck, when you were a teenager, you came last in a cross-country race. So what was your belief around your athletic ability at that point?
Oh, so I've reflected on this so much, and I was at school, and I think it's one of the biggest things that I hope I can perhaps inspire kids that you shouldn't get yourself put in a box, a metaphorical box when you're growing up. So I was always the, in inverted commas, a clever kid at school. I wasn't like bad at sport. I played tennis and netball. And I was above average, but I certainly wasn't athletic. And I did a little bit of running, and I must have been reasonably good because I think I got selected for the level above the school, so the Inter Grantham or whatever it was. Okay. And I came last, and there might have been a million reasons why I came last, but I didn't do coming last. And I've realised this 10, 15 years down the line, and I didn't do that. After that, I came last, I didn't do anything competitively. Until I entered my first triathlon when I was 26. And, you know, at uni I did a bit of running and just running, jogging, whatever. And friends were like, oh, why don't you do a marathon? There's no way I can do a marathon. There's no way I can do a running race. And someone's like, you know, why don't you do a pentathlon or something? No, I can't do it. And I think that coming last, for me, that was failing. I'd you know, deep down in my subconscious, I'd failed at something and I wouldn't let myself try again. And that's such a nice thing that triathlon's taught me, that you often fail at stuff, but actually that's what changes you as you go forward. So failure is only failure if it stops you doing something again, isn't it? But it's just really, I think it's really sad in some ways that coming last then impacted, you know, it stopped me doing anything. Who knows what opportunities I might have enjoyed had I not been constrained by the fact that I'd come last. So I told myself that I wasn't a runner.
Yeah. I'm interested to know what your thoughts are around confidence and arrogance, because I know you've got have had some pretty strongly held beliefs around arrogant behavior and how that then sort of impacted you as a competitor.
Yeah, so I think I always really struggled to distinguish between confidence and arrogance. And I remember going out for dinner just before the World Champs with Lucy Charles, who's now one of the best triathletes in the world. And at the time, she was an amateur. And I was, you know, we went out for dinner and she was so confident. And Mum came away. Mum loves Lucy now and they're good friends. But she said, oh, Lucy was quite arrogant. I'd done a bit of work with Helen, who's a sports psychologist friend, and at that point I could distinguish between she was just so confident in her abilities. But I still really struggle with being overtly confident and backing myself. And I do think it's a very fine line between being confident, and you need to be confident, but also I really have this fear of coming across as arrogant, which is kind of one of the things that I would absolutely hate anyone to ever think or ever say, oh, Lucy Gossage is really arrogant. It would be like one of the worst things in my head that someone could ever say to me. I've done a lot of work around it and realised that actually you do need to have confidence, and you can be confident without being arrogant.
Did that impact your performances at all? I know you've done, like you said, a lot of mental training with Helen, and I've heard you talk about your beliefs as a competitor. So that sometimes sort of thinking, oh, you didn't feel necessarily you belonged amongst the absolute elite. And we're one time racing and there was a woman who you sort of held in really high regard. And in your mind, there was this narrative that there's no way I could beat her, or no way I can overtake her. And then there was another time where you talked about you were aiming for the top 10 and there was someone else, Susie, I think was her name. Who was roughly the same ability. And she was, I'm going to want to aim for the top 6 or something like that. You came 10th and she came 6th. So I'm just interested, you know, between the relationship between confidence and then how that plays out in terms of self-belief and the importance of belief as a competitor.
Yeah, so the first story was actually my one of my first pro races, and it was the day after I'd just gone part-time at work, and it was in Ireland, and I was doing this race, and Rachel Joyce, who was one of the best in the world at the time, you know, I was literally a nobody, was racing, and obviously everyone was racing for second, and then I came off the bike, and the commentators were like, oh, this is a really close race, and I was thinking, what's going on? There must be someone behind me, and then I saw Rachel was in transition, and she was running out as I was coming in, and I was like, I remember it so. I sat down. It was a really cold day. Check it out. You know, put my shoes on. And I was like, I'm going to come second, very close behind Rachel. And we still had a half marathon. And you know, I knew I'd be running really well. But I just, I was like, I'm going to come second, really close behind her. That's amazing. And then we were running, and I could see I was catching her. And I was like, oh my gosh, you're going to come really close behind her. And this is halfway. And I just remember coming up to her and almost I had to consciously say, you are allowed to overtake her. And I did, and I won. And the first thing that I did, when she crossed the line, I went up to her and said, I'm sorry. And she was like, what are you sorry for? You had an amazing race. And, you know, I learned two things. One, that you can beat people who are on paper legends. And also I learned a lot about how to lose a race graciously. And I've talked a lot about that. the other story is, again, it's just in hindsight you realise it. So Susie and I were friends, and we were, again, on paper, identical. And we'd raced a few times, and there'd always been 1 or 2 minutes between us, and either I'd won or she'd won. Actually, probably I had the edge in terms of, you know, on paper, who's statistically. We were going to the World Champs, and all I wanted was to be in the top 10. She was very much, I will be in the top 6. I will be disappointed. I will be devastated if I'm not in the top 6. And I was like, I just really like to scrape in the top 10. And I realised, looking back, if it had been a top 8 that got, so on the in Kona, the top 10 get the wooden ball, which everyone wants. If it had been the top 8, I'm fairly convinced I would have come 8th. If it had been top 12, I'm fairly convinced I would have come 12th, which is quite interesting how your beliefs can inhibit you without even realising it, and how you often achieve what you aim for rather than perhaps better than you might have been able to do.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Yeah, and I know you've done a lot of work on this, and I'm really interested in the power of the stories we tell ourselves. So for example, when you were having that first race and you were having this, oh, I'm going to come, you know, a close second, and then eventually gave yourself permission to overtake her, were you conscious, were you aware that the story you were telling yourself, the belief you had about not being able to overtake her, was not based in reality?
No, and I think compared to a lot of people that become professional athletes, I didn't have that competitive background. So I had, you know, as I said, I came last and then I'd done nothing. I didn't have that experience of putting myself on the line as an athlete. And actually, when I think about my age group races, quite often if I came off the bike in the lead and there was someone who I thought was a better runner than me, I would be literally running along, jogging almost, waiting, looking at my shoulder, waiting for them to overtake me, breathing a sigh of relief, and then thinking, right, I can relax now, which is, you know, a ridiculous way to race, because who knows? And I remember one of the best races I did as an amateur was completely by surprise. I was in the lead off the bike, and I'd left my run timer on the bike, and I almost turned back to get it. You know, I was a minute down the road. I was so close to running back a minute to let this run timer, you know, my like speed thing. And I didn't, and I ran probably 30 seconds a mile quicker than I would have done had I been wearing that run timer, because I would have said I can only run whatever, 7 minute miles, whatever it was, 6:30, whatever. But actually, by not having it, I just ran as hard as I could, and I ran so much quicker. And that was really insightful as well, that what you tell yourself you can do, you will only achieve that if you don't let yourself believe that there may be more, or just experiment with what might be possible.
And those stories we tell ourselves, they're so pervasive throughout life, whether it be I'm sociable, I'm confident, I can get that job, I can't get that job, I deserve this, I don't deserve that. And like you said, in hindsight, it's often there whirring in the background and we're not even kind of aware of it. And I know you've done a lot of work in bringing it to the surface and then challenging it and saying, actually, to what degree is this true? Where is the evidence? So can you just talk a little bit about challenging those self-limiting beliefs, those stories that you had around yourself as a competitor, and how that can be applied in any other area of life?
So I'm quite a logical and rational person, and actually a lot of my thought processes were quite irrational, and the instinctive processes I have are still quite irrational. Like, you know, I might be looking at a start list and I might have beaten every single girl on the start list. Yeah, I would say, well, I only beat her because she had a bad day, or it was a fluke, or I just got lucky. And, you know, I might have had string after string after string after good results. Yeah, I'd still be turning up at, you know, in race week thinking, yeah, what, I'm not going to be anywhere in this field, they're all amazing. And Helen did quite a lot of work with me, just helping me challenge that by even doing really simple things like writing down my previous race results and saying, do you realize you've won 8 races in a row or whatever? I'm making up the numbers, but they can't all be flukes. And even I think for me, as a rational person, writing down, and you have to write it, for me, I have to write it down to make it real. That's quite a good way of challenging completely irrational thought processes.
So in terms of bringing the stories and the beliefs to the surface, and then, you know, in your case, sitting down, writing down, looking for evidence, how could someone apply that in everyday life to a belief they have, maybe about themselves, you know, I'm not a good person or whatever? And do you think you could have done it without the help of Helen?
Helen and I, as about a bit of background, Helen is a sports psychologist. She swims with me, or swam with me, and realised that when I was swimming, I was always just telling myself, I can't make those times, I can't do this, I can't do that. And she kind of nervously suggested, have you ever thought about doing some work on your self-talk? And I was like, no, my mind's my strongest asset. I don't need to do this. I'm really, and anyway, we eventually did it. And I grew to treat it like almost like a training session. So that in race week, I would factor in my psychological preparation in exactly the same way that I'd factor in my training. And I had a mental prep for race week that I used, and I realized it was silly things like watching videos of my previous races, writing down the good training sessions that I'd done, picking a training partner for a key session that week who would reinforce that I was fit. So I had a few people that I could call on who I respected, and if I could ride with them, then that was a positive validation. I did things like, the fact that I would timetable in a night off thinking about it, where I'd go out for dinner, and I would make myself go out for dinner with friends and forget about the race. And then on social media kind of fit. So there are loads of things that I used to do, but I actually broke them down. I had it in a timetable, exactly as I had my training plan that I'd write myself. And I think by making it an actual activity rather than just some vague thoughts that you might have on a run or a bike, it becomes more powerful. Can you do it on your own? Yes, 100% you can. You might need some guidance as to exactly what you're trying to work on and what beliefs you're trying to counter.
So, for example, I think like everyone knows someone who's a real glasses half empty type, kind of woe is me, my life's really kind of rubbish, and ignoring all the good stuff and thinking a lot of it's like automatic and conditioned and just is repetitive one day to the next. So spending time, first of all, becoming aware of the self-talk that is repetitive and automatic, then actually spending time, like what you've done, writing it down, looking for evidence, is this actually true? And then doing that habitually over time, so it becomes a habit, you can actually retrain the way you think. And I guess that's the idea behind things like people talk about gratitude diaries, for example.
Yeah.
Getting a new habit in place, what they say, what was it, like 66 days or something like that, on average, to get a new habit in place. So you are applying it on the bike in terms of your performance, saying, oh, I can't reach this time. But you can apply that same process to any other self-defeating self-talk that's going on, just by bringing it into awareness, challenging it, spending time working on it, and then habituating it.
Absolutely. And I can I've done a few talks about exercise and cancer at conferences, and one of the biggest ones I did was at the UK Breast Oncology meeting, and they invited me along. I said yes, and it was in London. I had in my head that it was going to be 30 people, and the start of my talk, I'd put some really cheesy music, and I was planning on getting them all up to do a bit of exercise, but 1 minute kind of high intensity exercise stuff. And I walked into this room, and it was in this really posh hotel in London, and there were maybe 300 people. They'd been there all day, and I just remember thinking, I can't do this. I can't possibly do it. And I remember sitting there, and there was some other talk, and I had to do, obviously didn't write it down, but used quite a lot of self-talk to give myself the guts to get up on that stage. And it turned out it was brilliant. And actually it woke them all up, and it was one of the things that I just most recently, I cannot do that. Oh my God, what the hell was I thinking? To give myself the confidence, and I guess remind myself that it had worked in smaller audiences, and that I believed in it, and that there was factual evidence that a bit of blood flow in at 3 o'clock in the afternoon the conference would do people good, and that I was confident enough, I could make myself confident, because it only works if I'd not gone up there pretending that I didn't have care in the world, it wouldn't have worked. I remember sitting down pretending to listen to this talk before me, actually in my mind doing a lot of self-talk about how the hell I was going to do this.
How long did it take you then to get good at getting a handle on your self-talk, to instill it as a habit and get good at it?
I think it's just something that you work on every time you make a decision, and I would still say that my natural instinct is to doubt myself and think that I'm not good enough when someone approaches me and says, do you want to do, I always feel a bit kind of, why do they want to talk to me rather than,
I think that's quite normal though, isn't it? I mean, like our brains are wired to negativity. The whole point of our brains being wired to negativity is like on the lookout for danger, because ultimately the most important thing is to survive. So the more kind of paranoid you are, the more likely historically you would have been to survive. So we've all got that negative bias.
Yeah, and I still sometimes have to often have to consciously take those thoughts away. I guess example, I just said I've entered a triathlon, and It's Helvellyn. It's in the, you run up Helvellyn at the end, and you know, I haven't trained as a triathlete. I'm fit, but I've retired. There are, you know, lots of people I'm sure will be like, oh, Lucy's coming out of retirement. I'm not at all. It's just a race that I want to do. I've got this itch to do something. I've got some friends doing it. But originally when someone said, do you want to do it? And I was like, oh, that sounds amazing. And then I was like, you can't, you're retired. You haven't trained for it. And all those, it wasn't really a conscious thing, but it was almost, it's almost now subconscious. Well, that might be what you think, but actually there's all these reasons why you can do it and you really want to do it, and there's zero reason not to do it. But that's almost, it's almost kind of happens automatically now.
So it's making the automatic conscious and then making the positive or whatever it may be a bit more automatic.
Yeah, I think that's right. Making the, oh, which way around? But for example, if it's, you know, if it's, I remember when it was, I was training really hard and I'd go out for my runs around the ring road in Nottingham after work and it was wet and all you wanted to do, it was late, your clinic had overrun, you just wanted to be at home with a, you know, your dinner on the sofa. And you know, I'd be leaving work, chuntering to myself about how miserable this was and how I didn't want to be doing it. But I could then very easily just, and I, it was a conscious thing, but so I had to make myself do it and almost say, yeah, but Lisa, you could be in that oncology ward, not able to do this, and yeah, tell myself. And that's, again, you can change how you view something. So your alarm goes off in the morning and you think, oh, I just want to stay in bed. But you can then tell yourself, well, actually, look at the sun. You're going to have this amazing run. You're going to really, you know, 10 minutes into the run, you're going to be so happy that you're out of bed. You can change.
Yeah, you can re-script stuff in the moment as well as like on a more long-term basis, basically.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And I think that's one of the biggest things that sports can teach you, because you often only find that you can re-script things from being in those really dark places that you get in sports events or challenges or whatever. But then you can take that into normal life. And, you know, like clinic yesterday, we were sitting in this room. It was probably about 35 degrees. There was a tiny little fan. We were, you know, doing all these phone calls. It was miserable. And it's very easy to get, we were running an hour and a half behind. I'd literally, you know, it's very easy to get built up on all the negatives. Or you can think of that, you know, you can turn it around into lots of positives. But it takes a lot of work. It takes mental power or mental energy to do that. You have to consciously do it. It doesn't just happen.
And like you say, I mean, I've never done, you know, endurance sports like you have. But if I go for a run, I quite enjoy that, you know, the voice when it starts chuntering up going, oh, your legs hurt, oh, this hurts, stop, oh, slow down. And, you know, the more you do it, the more you're like, oh, actually, that it's not me saying that. There's just some voice wittering away in my head. And I have a choice whether or not to engage with it.
Yeah. I was cycling up to Scotland off-road for my holiday, like the last couple of weeks. And we had some truly miserable days, but, you know, epic at the same time with, you know, horrendous weather. And there was never a minute, even though there were times, plenty of times where it was miserable and I was exhausted, there was never a minute that I didn't want to be there. And a lot of it, I do remember one day we had to do the last 2 hours on the road because we were just stuck. And it was, yeah, it was pretty, pretty crazy and running out of light and everything, but it was miserable. But I remember thinking, these are the days that you remember. This is when you feel alive, you know, when you're most out of your comfort zone. They're the days that they make you feel alive. And if you're stuck in an oncology bed, or, you know, who knows what's going to happen with COVID in the winter, I knew as I was in that misery that these memories would sustain me if lockdown comes back. I'd have that being completely out of my comfort zone that will get me through the winter, whatever happens. Hopefully I'll have lots more adventures in the winter. But if I don't, I've had those. I've been that close to being empty, and that's, those memories go a long way.
Yeah, it's just the perspective you take. And clearly the work that you do with oncology, with people who are being faced with the most difficult things you can really go through, that's clearly changed your outlook to be grateful, to understand that life is short.
Oh, yeah. And I, you know, I think I said it at the start, that seeing how humans deal with the most impossible situations is, it can be so sad. But it's also so life affirming. And I think, I mean, I work with a lot of young patients. So I treat sarcomas and testicular cancers, and have a lot of younger patients, so kind of 18 to 20, 25, whatever. And I think that's been the hardest thing about COVID for me, is watching them, particularly the ones who haven't got much time, seeing COVID stop them do what they would normally do with it, and seeing people, because it's seeing people who take every single opportunity to live life, have that opportunity taken away from them in their last few months because of COVID, has, I found it really heartbreaking, and I've got very angry on their behalf. Interestingly, most of them haven't been that angry. They've dealt with it, which again just shows the power of the human spirit. I'm continually amazed by how such young people can deal, and their families, but how they can be so mature and make such difficult decisions that are right for them. It's incredibly powerful when you see that every day. It's very hard not to appreciate, you know, being able to be well enough to get up at 6 and go and run with the sun coming up on a glorious day. And when you are sitting sweating in an oncology clinic without any water or whatever, it's very easy to remind yourself that actually you're pretty lucky to be sitting in the clinic doing the clinic rather than someone at the end of the phone waiting for their phone call that's 3 hours late to tell them their cancer's got worse.
Yeah, all about perspective and stories that we tell ourselves, isn't it? So you set up, well, you co-founded 5K Your Way, Move Against Cancer. And I want to talk a little bit about that. But something I saw that you wrote that I thought was interesting was that commonly healthcare professionals aren't great at looking after themselves. And a guy I know who's a psychoanalyst who was brought in to do a project with the NHS, he said the same to me, that caring professions, often the people within them are wonderful at looking after others and not so good at looking after themselves. And then you've spoken obviously about sport and elite sport to some degree being selfish, because, you know, you're doing it for yourself, you're just trying to make your time a little quicker or whatever it may be. I'm interested to know what you think, having experienced both those extremes, and what that says about the importance of, you know, of looking after yourself as well as the importance of looking after others.
Yeah, so I think firstly, being a professional triathlete, I loved it, full-time athlete. I had 2.5 years. It was incredible, but it's so much harder than people realise, having your whole life based around just making yourself quicker. And I really struggled. I've talked a little bit about the pressure, but I also really struggled with the fact that I felt like it was all a bit pointless, and it was all felt very selfish. And, you know, you're not doing anything that makes a difference to anybody apart from you. And particularly when you're injured, you're not sure whether you're going to be able to race. And, you know, I guess for everybody now through COVID, everything's not happened. I really struggle with, what is the point of me doing all this? Why am I doing it? What's it going to achieve other than making me better and quicker as an athlete? So I think for me, when I went back to work, I suddenly had that balance in my life, and I really valued every minute that I had to train, and it was very rare that I resented it, because it's far more restrictive, the time, but also I felt like I had some purpose in my life. I was doing something useful that benefited other people. I felt valued, I felt valuable, and that to me gave me a balance that I didn't have as a full-time athlete. And I guess, you know, learning from all the people that I see at work every day in terms of their suffering was also really powerful. So I think for me, balance is really important. And I think probably for a lot of younger athletes, actually, I think having some kind of avenue other than sports is really helpful and important. In terms of healthcare professionals, we are renowned for not looking after ourselves. There's a huge amount of obesity in the NHS. When I go and kind of talk to the kind of cancer nurses about exercise and physical activity, and I ask them how many do 30 minutes of exercise three times a week, there's very few of them. And diet, I mean, it's impossible to get good food in the hospital. It's a panini, if you're lucky, from the hospital kind of coffee shop. So healthcare professionals generally don't look after themselves. We're probably, I can imagine having a breast lump and kind of just telling myself it was nothing and then ending up presenting far too late. And I think a lot of doctors would be in the same situation without, you know, subconsciously perhaps. but I hope that 5K Your Way can, so 5K Your Way Against Cancer encourages anyone affected by cancer, so patients, their loved ones, their friends, their families, to walk, jog, run, cheer or volunteer at park runs on the last Saturday of every month. And seeing some of the healthcare professionals kind of get involved has been really, really rewarding, and seeing them discover exercise and the positive effect it can have on their lives is really, yeah, it's really powerful. And yeah, it's one of the things that makes me really happy.
As someone then who does have that balance between meeting your own needs and wants and what you want to do, while also getting your purpose from helping others and contributing to the well-being of others, like, what advice would you have, generally speaking, for getting that balance between yourself and other people?
So I think you can be at work 50 hours, 60 hours a week and be a 6 out of 10 doctor. Or if they're really honest with themselves, you could be at work 30 hours a week and be a 9 out of 10 doctor. And what is better? What makes me happy? Lots of things. Riding my bike, fresh air, seeing friends, doing something that I feel is helping people, whether that be 5K Your Way or seeing patients in clinic. What makes me unhappy is doing an average job and being an average doctor. So by working 5 days, I could see, say, 20 more patients, but I wouldn't be doing, I'd be an average doctor for them. Whereas I could see fewer patients, do it really well, perhaps benefit more people through 5K Your Way, etc. And then the other avenue that Ed talks about, I think, is the kind of, I can't remember how he classified it, but, you know, the money, that what pays for rent, what pays for bills. And obviously you have to factor in the maths around that. But generally speaking, the more you work, the less you get paid per hour because it's all taxed anyway. So that, again, is a bit of a no-brainer, as long as you've got, you know, you have to have enough money and be lucky enough to have enough money to make those decisions. But I think if a lot of people sat down and wrote down what makes them happy and how they can get that balance of what makes them happy from they're doing stuff for themselves and also doing stuff for other people. Because generally most people do get happy by doing stuff for other people. Certainly that's what I was missing as a full-time athlete. I wasn't getting that and I've realised that.
So by meeting your own needs, you could be better there for other people.
Yeah, that's very, very well put. I like that.
Excellent. Quickly, Lucy, because we're just going to wrap it up now, but in terms of your 5K Your Way, which is, you know, encouraging people who have cancer to consider exercise as a way to be healthier through their treatment and after. I mean, that's about right, is it?
Yeah, it's about encouraging and empowering people to take part in physical activity, but also the peer support network of being outside in the fresh air with other people who get what it's like to have cancer. That's it in a nutshell. www.5kyourway.org.
And what struck me about it as well is with COVID, I've read reports that lots of people have given up smoking, for example, and what you're prescribing in terms of exercise could be of real benefit to people who are wanting to improve their immunity with regards to this particular pandemic as well.
That's definitely true. And I take cancer out of the equation. I think the get fit for winter kind of slogan is really, really important. And it's that, you know, people are changing their lives because of COVID in terms of social distancing. But arguably, by getting themselves fit, they are going to be more robust if they do get it. And I think that's a message that needs to be pushed as much as possible, because it's probably the only thing that people can do rather than locking themselves away to minimise the risk of getting kind of seriously unwell if they did get it.
Are you concerned about winter and COVID?
Yeah, I am, but who knows which way it's going to go. Obviously, I hope it won't become a problem, but I suspect probably it will. I kind of don't see how it can't not, unless the virus just has mutated to a milder version. But we'll see. But that, you know, that's what I've actually used these words, I've said to my mum, live right now like you've got cancer, because we don't know what's coming in the winter. And if you make memories now, and now is, you know, it's a pretty safe time, make memories now, do fun stuff now. Those memories, if it does get tough, will sustain you through the winter, but not taking this opportunity that we've got at the moment with, you know, the sun shining and relatively low levels of virus and restaurants and things open, I think is silly. So I'm really trying to encourage everyone to to make the most of this time so that, you know, who knows, like we said all along, who knows what's coming tomorrow. So make the most of fun times whilst we have them.
A lovely sentiment, Lucy. Listen, thank you very much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Oh, well, thank you very much. And I love listening to your podcast. So great work.
Thanks very much for listening to this episode of Don't Tell Me The Score. I really hope you enjoyed our conversation. And I would, of course, be delighted to hear your thoughts, ideas and questions. Do get in touch via my website, simonmundy.com. I do really appreciate you listening. And if you could leave a kind rating and review, I would be sincerely grateful. All that remains is for me to say I hope you'll join me again next time. Until then, thank you and goodbye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.